Talk 105.9, the best of Roy Basnett.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast from the Roy Basnett Show. Each week we will be bringing you some classic moments from our award-winning programme on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool. Don't forget, if you want to hear the show live along with our latest guests and discussions, you can join me weekdays between 2 and 6am on City Talk across the North West and North Wales on 105.9 FM or DAB Digital Radio, or you can listen online at citytalk.fm. This week we hear from author and lecturer Jerry E. Smith. He believes the weather is not quite how it seems to most of us, and here's what he had to say.
City Talk 105.9, the best of Roy Basnett.
Well, good morning, Roy.
Well, there's no two ways about it, Jerry. If you wanted to be a real dominant force on the planet, militarily, I suppose you could say, then controlling the weather would be probably the ultimate weapon. I think controlling the weather would probably be better than a nuclear weapon. But is it possible to actually control the weather?
Well, yes, it is, simply put. In fact, you may remember the Battle of the Bulge during World War II.
Yes, yes.
One of the reasons why our side won is because we had control of the weather, at least control of fogs. That, you know, it was fought during a December-January time, normally of rather heavy fogs, and there were debilitating fogs across most of Europe during the battle. Mm-hmm. But the Allies had a fog dispersal system called FIDO, which allowed Allied planes to get up when the Jerries were stuck on the ground.
Oh, really? I had no idea about that. I'm totally familiar with it, and obviously I've seen the movie and stuff like that. But I really didn't know that technology existed.
Yep.
And that's going back to the Second World War.
Exactly.
So that probably tells you everything that you need to know. So, well, first, well, there's two questions, obviously. I've just put one to you there. Does it exist? And if so, who would be the people that control it?
Well, there are a number of players in this game. The U.S. is indirectly a player, and that's because during the Vietnam War, the U.S. military got caught with its fingers in the cookie jar. It was using weather as a weapon during the Vietnam War.
Right.
That was Operation Popeye. The idea of Operation Popeye was to use cloud seeding over the Ho Chi Minh Trail in hopes of turning the Viet Cong resupply route into a hopeless quagmire of mud. The program was ongoing from 1966 to 1972. There were some 2,600 sorties flown, dispersing 47,000 units of cloud seeding material over four countries, North and South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, the latter two in violation of international law, at an operational cost of about $21.6 million. When this got out, there was an international outcry, which led to a United Nations treaty banning weather as a weapon.
Hmm.
Now, that treaty went into effect in 1978. Prior to 1978, the United States federal government was spending between $40 and $140 million a year on developing environmental modification technologies, and not just weather control, but also a wide variety of modalities using various environmental processes.
Mm-hmm.
And the UN treaty is called the Convention on the Prohibition of Military or any other hostile use of environmental modification techniques.
Right.
Among the things that the U.S. was working on was intentionally melting Arctic ice, intentionally thinning out ozone ozone layer over the enemy so as to sicken the enemy populace through increased exposure to solar radiations. When the U.S. Signed on to the ENMOD treaty, the federal allocations vanished. They just went away. There were more than 700 degreed scientists working on this technology, and they all lost their jobs. Now, some people might think that Uncle Sam said, ooh, can't do that anymore. No. You may have heard this phrase a bit recently during the current war, civilian contractors.
Mm.
It all went out to civilian contractors.
Right.
And now there are, because civilian contractors don't have congressional oversight, don't have to reveal their budgets.
Yep.
So all the funding for it can be taken off budget, and
yep,
and Uncle Sam's fingers stay clean.
So they're away from prying eyes, effectively, aren't they?
Exactly, exactly.
Right.
So one of the big players in the U.S. in this is Weather Modification Incorporated of Fargo, North Dakota. Hilariously, in 2005, one of the senior scientists at Weather Modification Incorporated went on the international Art Bell radio show Coast to Coast AM and outed himself as having been one of the scientists involved in Operation Popeye.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly a link to civilian contractors there.
Right.
Now that's just in the U.S. There are other major players in the former Soviet Union and China. If you were paying attention this year, you know that the Summer Olympics were held in China.
Yeah.
And the Chinese, 6 months before the Olympics, promised, guaranteed, perfect weather for the Olympics. Now, the Olympics at the time of year they're held in China is the rainy season. And yet it was a beautiful, clear, blue sky on opening day. How did they do that? China had 37,000 full-time weather managers working to ensure that. And to ensure perfect weather, they actually used the technology developed by the Russians more than 30 years ago to keep it from raining on their May Day parade.
Is this where they kind of shoot things into the atmosphere, isn't it?
Right. It's a variation on cloud seeding in which they oversaturate the sky with the cloud seeding materials, but so that instead of forming grain droplets, it prevents the rain droplets from forming.
Right. I see.
But this this is a big piece of weather management and weather control and possibly weather warfare. Who is downwind of China? North Korea.
Mm.
China has been massaging the air over China for more than a decade, and North Korea has been in a drought for more than a decade. It is extremely probable that China has been stealing North Korea's rain.
Wow.
Which then gives China an incredible leg up on the North Koreans because it forces them to buy food from outside the country because they can't grow it in the country, and because their management are lunatics, the only people they can get to sell them food is China.
Right. Are we talking that a lot of the nations of the world have this technology then?
Either have it or have the ability to buy it.
Right. And yet this is against rules. This is against regulations, if you like.
Well, yes and no. Yes and no. The environmental, the ENMOD treaty I mentioned is a joke. There are 273 nations that are members of the United Nations. Of those, only 70 have signed this treaty. And the treaty is unenforceable in any real sense. And the treaty has a threshold to be violated in which a violation of it has to be widespread or long-lasting or severe.
Mm.
And those are nicely vague terms. So that it's and the treaty does not prohibit the development of the technology, only the hostile use of the technology. It was seen that if we could get a handle on the weather and earthquakes and volcanoes and tidal waves and tsunamis, that this would be overall good for mankind if we could prevent disasters.
Yeah.
So it was intentionally left open to develop the technology to manipulating this stuff so that humanity could benefit from it. But the problem is that if people since I was a kid, I learned of the Manhattan Project, which gave us the atom bomb.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dead certain that if it can be turned into a weapon, scientists will figure out a way to turn it into a weapon.
It's City Talk 105.9. My guest on the phone this morning is Jerry E. Smith. We're talking about weather warfare. We're going to be coming to the Hart facility in a very short while. It goes without saying, Jerry, that if this is possible, then why is it, for example, that if you look at somewhere like Africa, where you've got famine, you've got drought, surely if the weather could be manipulated, why don't they send clouds in that direction so they get a bit of water and they can live better? Why wouldn't they do that if they've got this technology?
Well, again, you have the question of who has the money, who has the belief. I think it's largely a matter of who benefits from it, and the peasants, regardless of what you do for the peasants, does it really benefit the ruling elite?
Right.
Those are the ones who have the money. Those are the ones who have the connections. Those are the ones who could use the technology.
Right.
The you and me's of the world. We're just hoping that somebody will do something nice for us.
Mm. So could we say then that, all right, you're saying that countries in Africa couldn't afford this kind of technology, and certain other nations around the world couldn't do. So if people have got this, they can do these things. They can manipulate the weather. How are they using it on a regular day-to-day basis? And if so, why are they doing it?
As I point out in my book, Weather Warfare, the military's plan to draft Mother Nature, Mother Nature gives great credible deniability. It's very difficult to determine if a rainstorm is natural or unnatural. It becomes very difficult to get the evidence unless they admit to it. An example of admitting to it, there is a Russian company that was a piece of the Soviet apparatchik that when the Soviet Union broke up, they spun off and became a for-profit company called Elate Technologies. You may remember in 1998, there were massive forest fires burning out of control in Southeast Asia, particularly Malaysia and Indonesia. Elate Technologies went to those countries and said, now in that part of the world, the big storms are called cyclones. In the Indian Ocean, they're called monsoons. In North America, they're called hurricanes. The Elate Technologies went to Indonesia, Malaysia, and said, "We have the ability to create cyclones on demand, and we could blow out your forest fires." And Malaysia went for it. Malaysia ponied up a never disclosed amount of money, hired Elate Technologies, who did indeed whip up their big wind technology, a cyclone, and blew out the forest fires. Also flattened hundreds of villages and left thousands of people homeless. I think that's called collateral damage.
Yeah.
You know, we may have seen this covertly used elsewhere. You remember Gulf War I.
Yeah.
It lasted, 56 hours. Gulf War II, they expected to be in Baghdad by Wednesday. And what happened? The moment they launched, a big wind came up. The strongest winds in recorded history, the worst sandstorm in over 100 years, and it nailed down the Allied advance for 3 weeks. I think it's very possible that Saddam Hussein went to his old friends, the Russians, and said, "Can you guys buy me some running time?" And they came back with, "How much cash do you have?"
Wow. That is incredible. I've got to ask them, I mean, if this technology is available, you really have to think twice about global warming then, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Global warming is very little like what the media and Al Gore are projecting it to be. One of the driving force behind the greenhouse gases causes global warming is the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change.
Mm.
This is a UN bureaucracy. This is an official department of the United Nations. It is staffed by UN bureaucrats and agenda-driven scientists. Before the big report was launched over the last year, there were 1,700 scientists who were members of the IPCC. Today, there are almost 500 less. 500 scientists who have been, I believe the number is like 390 scientists who have been doing, the guys who are actually in the trenches doing the real research, have quit in protest because the IPCC report has misrepresented the findings of their science.
Mm. Right. So what would be the purpose? What is the agenda? If we are being told that the world has got a problem with its climate change and stuff like that, and it might not necessarily be true, what would be the purpose of doing this?
Control. Weather control, climate control, global control. I firmly believe that Al Gore, when he failed to make president of the United States, decided to become president of Earth. And that the real agenda behind the IPCC and Al Gore, etc., is to create a global government with police powers, with teeth to enforce the edicts of the global government.
So we're talking about the New World Order here, aren't we?
Well, New World, Old World, we're talking about a really New World Order. You know, the traditional view of the New World Order are what are often called the banksters, the Rockefeller, Rothschild coalition, right. Now, those guys, that New World Order, they want to control the world so as to control the means of production and the means of generation of profit so as to ensure the profits get funneled through their pockets. These Al Gore and his people don't want to do that. They're a completely different animal. They, at the core of them, is an extreme liberal agenda that is convinced that Western civilization is a bad idea, that the way the first world works, our consumer-driven economy, is a crime against humanity. One of the mantras is North America consumes 80% of the world's resources, but only generates 20% of the world's resources. This is seen as a crime. And if North America won't pull itself together and put its house in order, then it has to be done for it. And so behavior modification is a big piece of this. If you I read the Guardian and the London Times often, and there are and the BBC, et cetera, and there are endless articles about how Brits are going to have to change their behavior. You know, they're not going to have to fly. They're going to have to stop flying to Spain every time they want a margarita. This is not about weather control. This is about population control. This is about consumer control. It's about control of our civilization, our culture.
So, let me see if I've got this right. Then you've got people like Al Gore who haven't. Well, they don't want us flying. They don't want us taking holidays.
Right.
And what would be, well, you know, if this is meant to be for the benefit of mankind, if what you're saying here, if global warming is, well, it's a nonsense, really, so therefore what comes out of the back of a plane is not going to damage the atmosphere anyway.
Oh, no, that's not true. That's another false spin on all this, is that my book, Weather Warfare, I spend 100 pages on this and 50 pages on aviation smog. What comes out of airplanes is changing the climate. Head of meteorology at MIT, after the 3 days of no-fly following 9/11, and the data got crunched on what an unaffected sky versus an affected sky is really like, the head of meteorology at MIT said that virtually all the warming over the last 20 years can be attributed to aviation smog, persistent contrails, or as some people call them, chemtrails.
Yeah. So, I mean, we'll move on to that because, I mean, this is the thing, and I've always made the comments. As a child, I remember looking into the atmosphere and seeing the contrail. The contrail would disperse within minutes of the plane leaving the airspace. I look in the atmosphere now, and it's a crisscross. Everywhere I look, there's a crisscross. This, unless I'm kind of not remembered in the past well, I don't remember it being like that. Would I be right in that way of thinking?
That is true. There have been some changes. In fact, there have been some very significant major changes that didn't make it into your school books. And the changes occurred, the big change, the sea change in the air, was in 1980, the high bypass turbofan was invented. Prior to 1980, jet engines were incredibly inefficient. They were the least efficient engine being used in the first world. And they spewed out 80% of their fuel as unburned and partially burned hydrocarbons. They left that vast black clouds behind them as they flew. And the condensation trail, you remember, was indeed a very short-lived affair, caused mostly by the pressure changes of air going over the wing and under the wing meeting each other, and the small amount of water vapor in the fuel. Now, what happened is after 1980, the high bypass turbofan turned the jet engine into the most efficient engine, and it went from 80% inefficient it went from less than 20% efficient to more than 90% efficient.
Right.
And you may remember in the 1970s, there were all these environmental debates about the disaster of unburned and partially burned hydrocarbons and how aviation smog was going to ruin the world and what could we do about it. And in the 80s, those debates went away. It's because those hydrocarbons went away.
Right.
The change, and not only did they change the jet engine, but they also changed the jet fuel to work more efficiently.
Mm.
Now, this produced more water vapor in the
contrail.
In the contrail. And from 1980 to 1998, the atmosphere over North America and Europe got warmer by about a half a degree. Now, the warmer the air is, the more moisture it can hold. So global warming contributed to, at least northern hemispheric warming, contributed to more water vapor being present. The change in the jet fuel led to more water vapor being present. And the jet engine, the three of them combined, produced these persistent contrails.
Mm.
Now, the persistent contrails are not benign. Now, whether there's a spraying program or not, it's very difficult to establish with any sort of certainty. What can be found from the open scientific literature is that in 1979, famed physicist Freeman Dyson, say that five times fast, came up with this bright idea that if global warming really were caused by greenhouse gases, it would be easy to mitigate. There's a word here I want to teach you. The word is albedo. That's the amount of solar energy reflected back into space by the Earth.
Hmm.
The oceans reflect a certain amount. The land reflects a certain amount. The Earth's albedo changes naturally. Whenever there is a big volcanic eruption like Mount Pinatubo or Mount St. Helens,
right.
That injects a tremendous amount of dust into the atmosphere, and it increases the albedo. So a number of scientific bodies, particularly Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, Lawrence Livermore has spent more than 20 years and more than $200 million looking at schemes to mitigate global warming, to change the Earth's albedo. And they have made two major proposals. One proposal was to put up giant mirrors between the Earth and the Sun, and the other is to inject shiny dust into the top of the atmosphere.
Mm.
If there is a spraying program going on, it may and well be a covert attempt to change the Earth's albedo and save us all from global warming.
Right, I see. So that could be a part of it. But it's a bit confusing now because on the one hand, we've got a group of people who seem to be, you know, wanting to use whatever technology is to benefit human race. And then, but I do get this underlying feel as though that there's obviously some people who want to use it for nefarious reasons.
One of my favorite science fiction authors, Robert A. Heinlein, said, "Never trust an altruist."
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am very skeptical of efforts to save humanity. As H.L. Mencken put it, efforts to save mankind are usually a false faith for efforts to rule him.
Right.
We need to look at who benefits. That's really the bottom line. The bottom line is the bottom line. Who benefits? Who is going to get their program, their wealth, their position furthered by this? And you see, Al Gore and company are looking to build a bigger and better UN bureaucracy with themselves at the top of it.
But it seems to me, as I say, and for the benefit of those who've just joined us, we're talking about weather being used as a weapon, if you like. My guest on the phone is Jerry E. Smith. If we're talking about this kind of stuff, the way you've worded it to me with Al Gore is that he's kind of say, almost as if to say, keep everybody in their houses, keep them from doing anything. We don't want them travelling around all the place. But that isn't for the benefit of mankind, is it?
Not really, no. But it is under their logic, you see, those folks, the extreme of the liberal collectivist movement, they want to return the first world to pre-industrial revolution status. One of the big programs is called the Rewilding of America Plan, the Wilderness Project. The Wilderness Project intends to turn 80% of North America back to the way it was before Columbus got here.
Well,
and you cannot do that and continue having strip malls and shopping centers on every other corner.
You also can't do that if you've got a population as well, Jerry.
Exactly.
It is City Talk 105.9. This morning we are talking about the ultimate weapon of conspiracy, if you like. We're talking about the weather. Jerry E. Smith is on the phone. I was beginning to get a little bit disturbed there, Jerry. I'll be the first to admit it. When you've got an agenda which could potentially turn 80% of the United States of America, back into, if you like, green space, it goes without saying you can't have your shopping malls, you can't have your industry, and you can't have the people there. If that's the case, what do you do with the population?
Well, what they're planning, and you can Google this and look it up, what the plan is to create reservations for humans, make the cities into mega cities, and then border areas that are farming, etc., and then complete wilderness. And this has moved out of the planning stage and is into actuality. As an example, a couple of years ago, I was at a local nursery buying some trees, and there was a woman in line ahead of me who had 5 acres of land, and she was bemoaning that the state had told her she could only plant trees and shrubbery in 2 of the 3 acres. The other 3 acres had been designated deer zone, and she was on a deer migration route, and she could not touch a single blade of grass in 2/3 of her property, or rather 3/5 of her property, and which she was like, bite me. I'm gonna plant some shrubs there because they just built a house and the bulldozers had torn up a piece of this, and she was tired of looking at that torn up bare ground and wanted to plant some nice plants. Which if the state found out about it, they could do some very serious things to her.
Really?
So this whole people's property and giving it to the animals is on the rise across North America.
So if that's what's happening in America, could we expect anything similar in our country here in the UK?
I haven't followed your country enough to know what the politics on the ground are like. But one of the things that's going on, you mentioned the New World Order in the previous segment, and I see there are two competing teams of New World Order. One are the banksters, the guys who want to keep the profits of the first world in their pockets and dominate the second and third world so as to extract the profit and control. The other I call the watermelons because they're green on the outside and red on the inside. They are very big on collectivism. Communism didn't die. It just changed from a red flag to a green flag. And these folks, they want the apparatchik in control so as to control our behaviors. They're not interested in the profit. They're interested in the control.
Wow.
And so there are each of these two schools are fighting each other in very different ways. The banksters have been creating a from the top down structure, NAFTA and GATT. The GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which gave us the World Trade Organization. That's a top down bankster view of how to control the world. But the watermelons have been doing it from the bottom up. They've been inserting their people and inserting their ideas. Doing kids' cartoon shows so as to inculcate the children, and doing local seemingly good ordinances that are actually modeled after. One of the things that's going on right now is that there are universal fire code, universal health code, universal building code, universal sanitation codes that sound like a good thing, except they were written by the UN apparatchik and are being foisted off on local populations across the country and around the world. I lived for the last 20 years in Reno, Nevada. And Reno, Nevada, without having a clue that these model ordinances were coming from the UN, adopted them all, thinking, wow, this is great stuff.
Wow. Well, what we've got so far, Jerry, we're obviously getting motive here, and we've obviously picked on, we've touched on a couple of subjects where organisations, companies, if you like, can manipulate the weather. One of the words or one of the abbreviations that constantly keeps coming up with me, people email me with it all the time, they want to know more about it or they're telling me information, and that would be the HAARP facility. This is HAARP. Could you tell us what that is, please, Jerry?
I would be delighted to. Now let me say before we go into that, I want to tell you I wrote a book about HAARP and I wrote a book about weather warfare. And my HAARP book is admittedly speculation. My HAARP book covers what HAARP is, what it might be able to do, and ask the question, who would want to do that? That is speculation, and we've been mostly speculating this morning. Mm. My book, Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature, is 400 pages of what I can prove.
Yeah.
I try to cut the speculation out, and what I did is I went to the internet and the conspiracy magazines and got all the conspiracy theories about what's going on,
yeah,
and then tried to confirm or deny the theories. And so it's 400 pages of, I won't say it's dry because it's really scary stuff, but it's factual, fact after fact after fact, whereas the HAARP stuff is a little bit more out there. So HAARP. HAARP is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. It is a field of antennas on the ground in southeastern Alaska, so linked together as to work as one giant antenna. And it is today the world's largest radio broadcasting station with an effective radiated power of 3.6 million watts. And I give you an idea, in the United States, the largest legal AM radio station is 50,000 watts. HAARP is 50,000 watt radio stations.
Hmm.
But HAARP is not designed to broadcast for human ears. HAARP uses a unique patented ability to focus the energy coming out of the field and inject it into a spot at the very top of the atmosphere in a region called the ionosphere. Now that spot is about 12 miles across by about 2.5 miles deep by about 50 or 90 miles up. Now, what happens when you inject 3.6 million watts of radio frequency energy into a volume of space that's very, very thin atmosphere, right at the very top of the atmosphere, is it heats the molecules of the atmosphere by several thousand degrees. And when you heat it like that, the molecules of the atmosphere literally blow apart. And when you break up a molecule, it gives off a packet of energy. And in that packet of energy is a stream of ELF, extremely low-frequency radio waves. The ELF penetrates deep into the earth and deep into the sea. The United States Navy admits that they have been using HAARP for the last 15 years or so to communicate with deeply submerged submarines. The other side of this is that when you blow the molecules apart, not only do you get this stream of ELF that goes down, the atmosphere itself is converted into a plasma, which is an electrically charged gas, and it goes out. Every time they use HAARP, we blow off a chunk of our atmosphere. And that plume of plasma goes out into space and keeps going until it runs into something to stop it, which is the magnetic field lines, the lines of magnetic force of the Earth's magnetic field. And this plasma gets trapped between the field lines and spreads out, forming a shield. It is a ground-based Star Wars weapon system, just as envisioned by President Reagan.
Mm.
They don't like to talk about that.
Right.
Now, what everybody agrees, even the detractors and the proponents all agree that HAARP is a research station, that they claim it's not a weapon, it's just a research station. And I will even go so far as to say, yes, it is just a research station. But what are they researching? This is the key thing. The people who are in favor of HAARP will go, it's just research. Don't worry about it. But what are they researching? They're very careful not to mention that, because what they're researching is not. It would lead you to believe that they're researching how the atmosphere works, the dynamics, the characterizing what goes on. No, that was done 30 years ago. That was finished 30 years ago.
Yeah.
They know the dynamics of the atmosphere today. What they're researching is how they can put what they know to use, how they can, remember, it's the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. This is how can they inject the energy into the atmosphere to make it do things. What things can they make it do? And who is funding this? Who's behind this? Who's directing this?
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. military. It's on property owned by the Department of Defense. It's being funded out of the Department of Defense defense budgets, primarily out of the Navy's pocket. The program is jointly managed by a U.S. Air Force and Navy team. It was recently completed. They started building it about 1990. They finished it. As best anybody can tell, they actually finished it in 2005. It was announced as finished in 2006, and they had a big ribbon-cutting ceremony in 2007. And this, there's some very every aspect of HAARP is fraught with that doesn't sound right.
Mm.
Here's one of those doesn't sound right. There are a dozen different people who say it was their idea. There are several different government agencies who say it was their idea. There's conflicting official stories as to how it got started and by who and when. That gives you something. And then we have here at the end U.S. Air Force Navy team in 2002 realized they were not getting the project done and contracted DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, to finish it. Now, DARPA is the top of the Department of Defense R&D mountain. They are the big guys.
Mm.
And DARPA only takes projects that they believe will significantly alter the outcome of wars, that will significantly change technology and how wars are fought.
Mm.
They don't mess around with little stuff.
So, they're not going to be. Well, obviously, it's going to be beneficial, but the idea that they've got this really, really incredibly good communication system, I would have thought would probably be low on the agenda there. They'd want more significant, wouldn't they?
Right. Well, the DARPA has 8 divisions, and the division that got HAARP was the TTO, the Tactical Technology Office. Now, the TTO's job is to develop something called force multipliers. Force multipliers are not themselves weapons, but things that, when put to bear, will increase the effectiveness of military personnel or systems. For example, if you could, as we talked about in the first segment, during the Battle of the Bulge, the FIDO fog dispersal system was not itself a weapon, but it did disperse the fog so that Allied fighters and bombers could get off the ground and win the war.
Mm.
That is a force multiplier. HAARP is a force multiplier, and that's why they gave it to the department whose job it is to make these things.
I see.
So the scientist in charge of HAARP at DARPA was a guy named Dr. Sheldon Meth. And Dr. Meth has a very interesting, besides an interesting name, he has an interesting career. For 20 years before going to DARPA, he worked for a company called SAIC. SAIC is CIA's spelled backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a damn good reason why it is CIA's spelled backwards, is because they were a R&D company whose primary client was CIA and NSA, the National Security Agency.
Mm-hmm.
They built toys for the top spooks. And Dr. Sheldon Meth got the job of building HAARP, apparently a toy for the top spooks. Meth, at the time he got the project, was running 3 other projects. 2 were laser projects. One was Laser Star, the other Air Laser, and a rather peculiar item called the Magnetohydrodynamic Explosive Munition, whose acronym comes out to Mayhem. He had Laser Star, Air Laser, HAARP, and Mayhem. Sounds like a couple of the horses of the apocalypse.
Yeah. Mm. So, if that's now we've established quite a bit of stuff about it there, what do you believe that the HAARP facility could be used for?
Well, there are a number of things. It is a suite of uses. They admit to having done a number of things with it, including creating optical and infrared trackers in space so as to calibrate space sensors. They admit to using it to communicate with deeply submerged submarines. They admit to using the side effect of communicating with submarines, that is the generation of the plasma, which is what the darn thing was designed to do in the first place. They admit that when it goes out until it hits the magnetic lines of force, which are the Van Allen belts.
The radiation belt, yeah.
Exactly. The radiation belts are radiation trapped within the magnetic lines of force. HARP overburdens them and forces them to precipitate out. Now, this is good for spacecraft, and then if you want to get a spacecraft up, it has to go through the radiation belts, and if you can thin the belts out, well, that's good for the payload. Mm. The problem is that means that that hard radiation is coming to Earth. And
right.
I guarantee there has never been an environmental impact study done on what happens when that stuff comes to Earth.
Right. I see.
Now, my conspiracy theory, and what HARP is being done for right now, is that it is being used to prevent hurricanes from coming on shore in North America. As I said, DARPA got the project, and as best we can tell, DARPA actually they farmed it out to BAE Systems North America. You may remember BAE as the former British Aerospace.
Yeah.
BAE Systems is one of the world's largest defense contractors. BAE Systems North America, I think, is the fifth largest defense contractor in the U.S.
Right.
BAE Systems gave it to their Electronic and Information Warfare Division. I guess that kind of said a little bit too much about what they were doing with HARP, and they changed the name of the division to Integrated Solutions.
Right, yeah.
Right? They raced it into completion. It was the contract said HARP was supposed to be completed in 2007. As I said, independent researchers listening to the HARP signal, and the HARP is an audible radio signal in the high frequency range, which is just below the frequencies used for shortwave radio. And if you have the right equipment, you can listen to the signal. And there were a number of folks who listened to it and said that 2005, every day, it would be up for a couple of hours at night. And what it looks like happened is that during the day, they installed the new antennas and the new transmitters, and they wired everything up. And then at night, they tested the wiring to see if everything worked right.
Right.
So that stopped just before Thanksgiving 2005. That stopped in late November 2005. In March of 2006, the DARPA website for Dr. Sheldon Meth's department announced that HARP was completed, done, and that he and his team were transitioning control of HARP back to the Air Force Navy team. That website is now gone, and Dr. Meth is gone. He's now the head of science at another private civilian contractor, and the control of the project is backed in Air Force Navy hands. Now, the curious thing is that HARP was finished officially. DARPA washed its hands of it in March of 06, but BAE Systems didn't do the ribbon cutting until June of 07 on the contract deadline. Why did they hold off for a year and a half before admitting, oh, by the way, we're done? Well, how often are military projects brought in a year and a half early and under budget? Something suspicious here. Something doesn't sound right, as I said earlier.
Mm.
What we have here is, if you remember, in 2005, the hurricane season in North America was the worst on record. It had the largest number of named storms and the largest number of Category 4 and 5 storms making landfall. And the weather pundits were saying 2006 was going to be even worse. HARP is finished just in time for the 2006 hurricane season. And what happened? Nothing. Not a single hurricane
so
made landfall in 2006.
It prevented these things from happening.
Right. And what happened in 2007? Nothing. Not a single hurricane. There's never been, in recorded history, 2 years with zero hurricanes. And why did these 2 years with zero hurricanes happen? There was an anomalous, an unexplained and unexplainable high-pressure dome parked over the southeastern United States throughout the hurricane season. In fact, it generated itself a few days before the official beginning of the season and fell apart a couple of days after the official end of the hurricane season. Very convenient. Now, this high-pressure dome Well, it acted like a rubber bumper on a pinball game that the hurricanes, like pinballs, hit them and bounced off safely out back out to sea. But under that high-pressure dome, you had intense heat. You had people dying from the heat. You had wildfires. You had crop loss. Lots of destruction, lots of numerical value, big money destruction. And so the folks at HAARP could not take credit for, hey, we saved Baton Rouge. We saved Louisiana. We saved Florida from these hurricanes. They can't take credit for it because they'd also have to admit that they fried Georgia.
Right. I see. So, based on what you're saying then, Jerry, and it's Jerry Smith that we're talking to on City Talk 105.9 this morning, that they seem to be doing it with the best intentions.
2006 was an election year. After Katrina and the disaster in New Orleans, the powers that be knew that another devastating hurricane season would be, you know, a recipe for civil unrest. And so they just nipped it in the bud. Now, are they doing it because it's the right thing to do, or are they doing it because it's the good thing for them? It just happens that for beach owners in Florida and the Bush administration, their needs and wants and desires happen to coalesce. On the other hand, I had a friend who died in Georgia from the heat because she was a shut-in and a pensioner and couldn't afford air conditioning.
Wow.
So what's good for George Bush was not very good for Vita Louise.
So you talk about the potential there, and obviously we are speculating on this one, Jerry, that they used the facility, the HAARP facility, to pretty much guarantee George Bush's re-election to a certain degree.
To attempt to keep the landslide from going in the wrong direction at any rate.
Right.
This is speculation. This is based on connecting the dots, and I could have the wrong dots or could be misconnecting them.
Mm.
That is the problem with conspiracy theories, is that you have to, in order to get the right answer, you have to have all the dots and have to correct them correctly connect them.
Mm.
And the hilarious thing, I think, is that mainstream media laughs at conspiracy theory. And yet, if you talk to any three people in prison in the United States today, two of them are there convicted of felony conspiracy charges. The U.S. U.S. Justice Department loves conspiracy too as a charge.
Yeah, I see what you're getting with this. Yeah.
And two-thirds of American prisoners have been convicted of conspiracy too.
Yeah.
So even if the U.S. government doesn't believe in conspiracy theories, the Justice Department sure as heck does.
Mm. I've got to ask then, Jerry, just before we kind of get towards the end of this, the last two summers in the United Kingdom have been absolutely dreadful. Would there be any reason for me to assume that something's not quite, and perhaps maybe we're being given a bit of a bum deal on the weather?
As they say on the cop shows, that's leading the witness and calling for speculation. I do not know. To be perfectly honest, I have no clue.
Mm.
The question is, who benefits?
Yeah.
If you can find a class of people who have potential control and are reaping a benefit, there's a significant chance they may indeed be.
Mm. Jerry, please just tell us, if you would, about the books that you've written and websites that people can go to if they want to find out more details.
Okay, I am Jerry E. Smith. That's Jerry with a J, J-E-R-R-Y, middle initial E, S-M-I-T-H. I have a website, which oddly enough is jerryesmith.com.
Right.
JerryESmith.com. Each of my books, I have three nonfiction books out. HAARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, which has been translated into Portuguese and Polish. And Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature. And in between them, I wrote Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend, which we just sold to a Mexican publisher to be translated into Spanish.
Hmm.
If you visit my website, I have a section on each of the books which will give you a whole lot more information so that you can make up your own mind and do your own research, do your own due diligence. The Weather Warfare books bibliography is 32 pages long, and I have about 20 pages of the bibliography on the website, so you can you can follow along in your hymnals, if you will.
Okay.
I have articles and transcripts of speeches I've done. I also have a large biography section with photos of me, and then I have a collection of articles I've written and a book of my poetry, God Save Us. I mentioned Robert E. Heinlein earlier, but one of my favorite quotes from Heinlein was, "A man who recites poetry in public will commit other crimes as well."
And we got to mention the bookshop in Liverpool that you actually came over to.
I was in Liverpool just 5 months ago. Urban Myths, a bookshop in downtown Liverpool in the Grand Central Building, sponsored a conference, and I was. Privileged to be one of the speakers, and they have all of my books in stock. So you can, and I really recommend you go into the Grand Central Building. It's an amazing place. Apparently, the last owners try to do it as turn of the last century Art Nouveau nightclub, and the interior is absolutely spectacular. It is truly psychedelic. Right. A la 1909.
Excellent. Well, listen, Jerry, sorry, we've got to finish it there, but I would love to continue. And hopefully what we can do is maybe look into some other areas and we can get you back on the show again, if you're okay with that.
I would be delighted to.
And that's this week's podcast from the Roy Bassnett Show on City Talk 105.9. Don't forget, you can join me live on the radio each weekday morning between 2 and 6 a.m. on City Talk across the North West and North Wales on 105.9 FM or DAB Digital Radio. And of course, you can listen live online at citytalk.fm. That's it for now. Catch you next week.
City Talk 105.9, the best of Roy Bassnett.